To say a few words this evening about the fine art of chanting and how to do it and how the kind of role it plays in the spiritual life. And I guess I was sparked in this by this photo which surfaced yesterday, which some of you saw of me in my singing days, and then what I imagined was the Hounds of Dilemma, which I'd imagined had disappeared forever. Suddenly, then I get an image, and there's a picture of me singing, or at least vocalising, perhaps might be a more generous term. And so, of course, in doing the chanting, then where it's like a kind of sacred singing, or a sort of giving voice to our sacred texts in a way that is, of course, very widely done, very universal, and something I did as a child growing up in the Catholic tradition, both through the hymns that we would sing, but also the liturgy which we would say during the Mass, the Nicene Creed and other things, Lord's Prayer and so on. So I kind of was drilled, or you know, used to sort of participating in a kind of vocal way in that kind of sacred ceremony. And this kind of thing, of course, is very widespread. And if we look in Buddhist cultures, the practice of chanting is extremely popular and found very strongly emphasized in all the different Buddhist traditions. And of course, all the traditions do the chanting in their own way, but all, in some sense, have some kind of using it in a way of both kind of an immediate practical sense of simply stating the Dhamma, you know, saying this is what the Dhamma is, and sharing that teaching among a group of people, but also in a more subtle sense of creating a space, a contemplative space, or a space of, paradoxically, a space of silence, where those sacred words are spoken and they occur within a framework or a context which actually leads to peace and leads to a quiet and silent state of mind. So of course the practice of chanting, as we all know, is around long before the Buddha, and was always very characteristic of the Indian tradition. And as we've discussed often, the Indian tradition was a purely oral tradition in terms of its religious texts at the time of the Buddha, and the scriptures, the Vedas, had been passed down literally since time immemorial. I don't know about literally time immemorial, because it's I certainly don't remember when the time was, but the memory is actually what passes these things down. And this is, I think, a very interesting aspect about the nature of chanting, is that if it's done through the oral tradition, then it uses memory as its means of transmission, or one of the key factors in the means of transmission anyway. And in fact, that's so important that many of the Indic scriptures are called the Smriti, which means those things that are remembered, the texts that are remembered. So, if we again, as I always like to try to understand these things through sort of going back and placing myself in the kind of the mindset or the state of the people in that time. And so, if you're in that time and in that society, you have these verses, sacred verses, which are in a sense perceived or imagined, or they're like, it's like the inspiration flows through you and they come out spontaneously. In a sense, not dissimilar to what I'm doing here. I'm, spontaneously coming out with sayings and sentences and so on, which somehow are put into a grammatical form and sentence structure without me thinking about it too much. It just happens. And for the creators of the Vedas, they would do that, except of course it would come out in a verse form. And, that seems astonishing to us, that people could spontaneously improvise verses, but in fact it's not that difficult if you're used to doing it. I used to do it when I was busking and other things, and quite commonly you just improvise verses and so on that would have a rhythm, a rhyme and structure, and it would just be part of the art, part of the craft of what you're doing. So I would come up with these verses, and the verses would always accompany, or generally speaking, would accompany some kind of act, some physical representation. So that you typically would be doing a ritual of some kind while the verses are being performed. In a similar way to what we do when we come here and when we're chanting, we bow down and then we sit in the polite posture and so on. So there's a ritual component to the verses, even though of course it's much simpler than the complex rituals of the Vedic sacrifice. And there's also an intentional aspect there too. And of course this also is recognized in the pre-Buddhist tradition, the Vedic tradition, where you are supposed to not just intone the verses, but you're also supposed to understand them. And this being the great refrain, probably the most common phrase in all of the Upanishads, is Ya Evang Veda, one who knows this. And it always kind of refers back to a particular interpretation or connection or meaning that's drawn out of a Vedic verse or idea or ritual or something like that. One who knows this, Ya Evang Veda. So that the person who's conducting the ritual, taking part in the sacrifice, doing the chanting, who understands what's going on, is the one who will really reap the benefits of it, whereas one who simply does it mindlessly won't get much out of it at all. So these three aspects of body, speech and mind, which are of course very characteristic of the Buddhist way of training, and all kind of present there, ready in the culture, waiting for the Buddha to come. Now, when we look at memorizing verses, of course one of the things that we always find when we come along to memorize verses is that we find it very difficult, it's hard for us to memorize things. And of course that's largely an outcome of our culture, the way that we're educated. And our education system very much emphasizes sort of inquiry and analysis and critical thinking rather than rote learning, and we tend to be quite dismissive of rote learning. And which in a sense is kind of a shame, and perhaps it's gone a little bit too much that way, and perhaps a little bit more rote learning might be useful. There's nothing wrong with rote learning as such. The problem is if you just have rote learning without the inquiry and reflection that should go along with it. And so this is, of course, different in different cultures. When I was in Bodh Gaya a couple of years ago, one of the monks there was saying that there are three good qualities of the Indian monks, Indian bhikkhus, was that they had good memories, they had a lot of faith, and that they had a lot of patience and endurance, very good, a lot of contentment. And so that, you know, he kind of noticed that the kind of a good memory was one of the outcomes of a kind of culture which still values rote learning. So for most of us, because we haven't learnt how to memorize things so much when we're children, then it's much more difficult to remember the verses. And for myself, of course, it was much easier because being a musician, you're used to memorizing pieces of music, and you know, that's sort of trained that faculty very regularly for many years, so it was never that hard for me to memorize things. So what I'd just like to just reflect on here is the kind of the meaning or the nature of what we're doing when we're remembering things. And the essence of the idea is that there's some kind of pattern, some kind of meaningful pattern in these words, the sounds, the rhythms, the etymology, the history of the words, the associations that they bring, all these different aspects of the terms, the way that the different words that we hear, like metta or kanti or other Pali words that we hear, we recognize in the chanting, and they have a certain set of connotations for us. And this kind of complex and nuanced set of patterns is what's kind of passed down or given solid form through memorizing the chanting. And so by memorizing it, it helps to give a clarity and a structure to our Dhamma knowledge, which otherwise can be kind of vague or can be lost. It can be easy to not really be clear in ourselves about how we think about things or where we put things. So memorizing the chanting helps us a lot in that way, and it helps us in the sense of having like an instant access to teachings when we need them. In our practice, you know, we can remind ourselves if we have a problem. We're sitting in our kuti and feeling kind of depressed or lazy or something like that. Then you can just remind yourself in the Pali, viriyena dukkhamacchayati, you know, by means of energy that one crosses over suffering. And so just having that there, having it at your fingertips, it's very, very useful. It's a very practical kind of tool. And so by chanting these things regularly and by memorizing them, we're creating a structure in our mind, creating a certain pattern. We're firing those neurons in that particular way, we're forming the connections in that way. And so in doing so, we are purifying and perfecting our faculty of right speech, as well as helping to perfect our path factor of right mindfulness through being able to memorize the scriptures. Now, one of the come back to the pre-Buddhist situation. You know, there's this description in the Brahmanical scriptures where it talks about how the one who was trying to memorize the Vedas, and remember that the Rig Veda is about something over 10,000 verses. In comparison, the Dhammapada is around 500 verses. So we're talking about something that's 20 times as long as the Dhammapada. So when they were memorizing the Vedas, they would, in the morning after doing their rituals and chores and so on, they would go away a little way off into the forest, find a quiet place to sit, and they would make their dedication, and then they would sit down quietly and clear their mind and recollect the verses and keep on going over them and over them and over them. And so this was, I think, very interesting, because of course that method of memorizing the verses is basically identical to the method that we use for meditating, and it's essentially exactly the same thing. And we can also, it's very easy to imagine that in that kind of state, that, if you're very kind of devoted to these verses, you see it as a sacred duty, have a lot of faith in them, then it would be very uplifting to the mind, bring a sense of joy and peace to the mind, which is literally a divine experience, a sacred experience which you're having as you're reciting. So it's not a kind of dry thing. So these are all good qualities to bring to our practice and the way that we go about chanting and so on. So when we want to learn the chanting, we should remember this, remember that it's not just a chore or a task that we do, not just a worldly thing, but it's actually a sacred task. And it's something which is shared and common in the whole Sangha. All of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis of the past have all memorized and learned verses of the Dhamma, many of them the same verses that we're memorizing for thousands of years. And just as a side note here, just to note that in the Indian epigraphical record, there's quite frequent mention of bhikkhunis as being learned and knowledged in the scriptures and the Tripitaka and so on. So even though the stories of the councils place the text in the hands of the monks, but there's no doubt that the bhikkhunis were also playing their role in memorizing these and passing them down through the generations and through the ages. So these texts, these particular specific words, provide a continuity in the Buddhist tradition from the past to the future. And I think this is very nice. This is one of the reasons why we're chanting the paritas that we do here at Santi, we focus on the canonical text of the paritas rather than the later post-canonical text. And if you have a look at the chants which are done typically in Thailand that I learned when I was at Nanachant, there's a mix of some ancient Sri Lankan chants, some canonical chants, and some quite recent ones composed in Thailand, I believe, in the 19th century. So to me, this is it's better to focus on those which are really fundamental, which are taught by the Buddha, which are common to all the traditions, and which incidentally have much better Dhamma teachings in them than the later ones, which tend to be much more flowery and technically showy-offy in terms of their poetics, but don't really have so much content in them. So when we come to learn these, for many of us, if you have not been a musician or not been in some other kind of, not learned some other similar kind of skill where you've had to memorize things, then it'll be a challenge to do this. So take it as a challenge. Don't take it as a drudge or a chore or something, but take it as something which gives you the chance to learn some of those skills with your mind that are typically neglected in a modern Western education. And yes, it's hard, but the fact that it's hard means that you're actually training your mind in a good, important new way, and you keep on doing it until those mental skills, you become proficient at them. So when we're memorizing the texts or memorizing the suttas, so this is there's some, I think, important things to bear in mind that will make it easier. The first one is that we should know what it means, and that the knowledge of what it means should be very specific, not just a general knowledge of what the particular verse means or sentence means, but we should have a specific knowledge of what each word means as we're memorizing it. So we do that as part of our study. We take the time to check with the translation, gradually learn these things, check each word, look up the dictionary if there's words that you don't know. And most of the time it's not too difficult to work out what each of the words means, pretty much. Some of the words might be a bit obscure, but most of them you can work out fairly easily, with a bit of effort, what each of the words means as we're chanting them. And so when you're memorizing each verse, you know, do this as you memorize each verse, and so you have a clear knowledge in your mind. Remember that this is one of the great opponents to memorizing, or memory, is doubt. And so when there's a doubt in the mind, lack of clarity, then it's much harder for our memory to work properly. So don't have any doubts about what you're chanting. Make sure that you know the meaning precisely, and make sure that you know the pronunciation precisely. So we've had our classes before, and it's described in the chanting books about how to pronounce each of the letters and so on in Pali, and ensure that you know that. Practice it. If you're not sure, then ask myself or someone else, and to check your pronunciation and to make sure that your pronunciation is correct. There's a right way and a wrong way of pronouncing Pali. Unfortunately, there's not this relativist modern idea of grammar, and pronunciation doesn't apply to Pali. It's a fixed ancient dialect which is described very specifically in the old text, so we know exactly how it should be pronounced. And if you don't pronounce it that way, you're wrong. All right. So again, there's no need to have any doubt about this. It's phonetically written, and you can read it and pronounce it perfectly just by reading it. So you should keep practicing this until you can do that, until you can simply pick up any verse of Pali and immediately pronounce it so that every letter is correct and the rhythm is exactly correct and so on. And so again, the more doubts you have about that, the less certainty and clarity in your mind, then the harder it will be to remember it, the more you'll stumble and make the task, both make the end result inferior, but also make the task a lot harder. So these are two, I think, very important things to bear in mind when we're chanting, when we're memorizing things. Another important thing to remember when we're chanting is what I alluded to before, is that it's primarily focused on the speech, but actually it's a body, speech and mind. So everything is focused on there. So, you know, be aware of your body as you're chanting, and when you're learning it, either sitting down, or very commonly people like to learn and practice chanting while walking, as I myself do. And I always learnt most of my chanting on the walking meditation path. And so when you're doing that in the walking meditation path, then you compose your body and you're ready to walk mindfully, as you do when you're doing walking meditation normally. And you have the chanting book there to learn it, or else if you're just reciting something, recalling something you already know, then just keep on going over that. So this is also another important thing, so that your body is in the right attitude, your mind is in the right attitude. You know, you have faith in what you're reciting, and that you see it as a valuable and essential thing. And so there's a sense of uplift and a sense of joy that comes from remembering the Buddha's words. You can actually make your mind very happy and very positive. When we're reciting and memorizing things, it's important also to memorize them in chunks that are neither too big nor too small. One thing to remember is, I know one monk in Thailand who tried to remember one syllable at a time. So the Ratna Sutta, ka, first one, then yang is the second one. We got that one, ka, yang. And it's going to take a little bit longer. The lines of the verses and so on have a natural length. The language has its own natural length, which tends to be about a breath, you know, like a phrase or a sentence or a line of verse. And so learn it by those units, like a natural unit of speech, rather than too short, probably be word by word, or too long, sort of verse by verse. But line by line is about the right length. And it's also important, the other important thing is to master each section before moving on with the next. Okay, so if you're learning the verses, say the Mangala Sutta, Sevana Chabalanam Panditanam Chisevana Puja Chapujanyanam Etam Mangalam Uttamang. Make sure that you really know that verse really well and that you can recite it without looking at the book, without stumbling, without doubting about it. Okay, and when you're very clear about that, and then go on and learn the next verse. And when you finish learning that next verse, then you come back and learn the first verse, practice the first verse and the two of them together, and ensure that you have those two done, okay? And then come back to the third, make sure you know that one well, and then come back and learn the three verses together. And you'll find that that there's a certain quantity which you're comfortable with learning each day, and keep that. It's much better to keep that quantity relatively small, maybe just a few verses per day, or even just one verse per day, it doesn't matter. But keep on practicing that every day and don't let it get rusty. So for the first year or two, make sure that you keep practicing these things every day. That's the way to learn them, and the way that they'll stick with you for the rest of your life. I was talking about this in Perth with Mayama and Ayaseri, because Ayaseri just memorized the Kuni Patimokkha. Of course, being a great achievement to be able to do that. And I was saying that, you know, when you memorize these things, you have to keep on going on them after you've finished. And I remember when I'd learnt the Patimokkha, I made a determination that I would practice the whole of the Patimokkha, or at least half of it, every day for a year. So I recited every day for a year, at least half of the Patimokkha, if not the whole thing. And I'd usually do that when I was on alms round, or when I was on the walking meditation path, or something like that, or walking to my kuti. And so, you know, you can find times like that to do it. So you might say, well, listen, I'll go over the chanting. If you have a kuti that's a little bit distant from the house, and you, when you're walking out in the morning, then you can go over those chants. When you're walking back after the meal, that can also be a very useful way to recollect your mind, because sometimes we get a bit scattered during the meal time and with the chores and so on in the morning. And so when you're walking back to your kuti, you can say, well, listen, I'll go over the verses that I learnt yesterday and revise them. And that can be a good way of bringing that concentration back. And then you can go and learn the new ones you want to learn that day afterwards. So these are just a few practical tips in how to memorize the verses, or how to bring the mind and so on, bring them to mind, and how how to make sure we keep them there. Of course, one of the suttas, the Brahman, a Brahman comes to the Buddha and says, sometimes I can remember the Vedic mantras and sometimes I can't. Why is that? And the Buddha said, well, it's because you have the five hindrances. And when you have the five hindrances in the mind, then you can't remember, or it's more difficult to remember. When the five hindrances are absent, then you can remember. Interestingly enough, there's a passage in the Upanishads themselves where it talks a similar kind of dialogue, but there what happens is that the student, the teacher asks the student to fast. And when the student goes without food for a few days, they become weak and feeble-minded and they can't remember the Vedas anymore. And then they have something to eat and their memory comes back. And so the conclusion there is that your memory is dependent on food, which is kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? I find that an interesting idea. So anyway, from the Buddhist point of view, of course, has a more psychological point of view, and that it's the five hindrances that are stopping us from remembering these things. And of course, five hindrances are of course exactly the same as the things which are obstructing our meditation. So again, showing that the meditation and the chanting are not two distinct things. They're actually quite similar, very closely related. And my metta meditation teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai, would always say that chanting is the kugan, the pair, or the partner of chanting, the partner of meditation. And in the Thai tradition, they'll often do a couple of hours of chanting every day. So it's easy enough to see how these five hindrances are really an obstruction to meditation. If we have karma chanda in our mind, sense desire, then we're trying to meditate and our mind's thinking about, you know, whatever, sex or food or something that we want or whatever. If we have anger in our mind, then the mind tends to get dominated by these sort of thought, negative thoughts and trains of thought that are angry or have ill will towards somebody. And again, it's very hard for us to concentrate on the Dhamma when our mind's like that. When our mind, of course, is sleepy and lazy, then of course it's very difficult to remember anything. But which also points to the fact that chanting is a very good antidote for sloth and torpor. If you're meditating, especially late at night in your kuti, then chanting is a very good practice. And sometimes at santi, if it's a bit cold or a bit wet outside or something like that, and if it's at night time and you don't want to, too tired to do sitting meditation, but you don't want to go outside to do the walking meditation because it's a bit cold, then do some chanting before you go to sleep. And sort of bring your mind to the Dhamma and refresh your mind and so on for half an hour before you go to sleep is a good practice. The restlessness and remorse, of course, the restlessness of the mind especially being a quality which is makes it hard for us to learn the chanting. Our minds tend to scatter off and think about this and that rather than focusing on the task. So keeping on bringing the mind back, applying the mind to the chanting again and again and again, we're exercising that vitakka vichara, that mind which is applying itself over and over and over again on a single wholesome object rather than letting it wander off and just do what it wants to do. So it's very good for helping support samadhi in that way. And then of course the last one being doubt, as I mentioned already earlier, that doubt is one of the major obstacles to memory, almost a direct opposition to it. And so it is really a very, very powerful way of being able to clear up doubt, to gain certainty in oneself about what the teachings are, what this particular sutta says, about what the Pali means and all of these things. And we gain all that kind of certainty through the chanting. So all the chanting helps us to overcome all of these five hindrances, and so it's a great support for our meditation. It helps our meditation improve, and that's why every meditation tradition will do some chanting in one way or another. And certainly in the forest tradition they do a lot of chanting. And the other benefit that the chanting has, of course, is it's always reminding you of the teachings. And this is one of the things, the nature of the Dhamma is that it's part of the profundity of the Dhamma is that it kind of reveals itself gradually. It reveals itself little bit by little bit. When we first read something, we think we know it, we think we understand it, or maybe not, we think we don't understand it, but then we ask, inquire, we get an understanding of what it might mean. But then as we keep on reciting it, keep on learning it, gradually it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. We see hidden connections, hidden resonances. And it's not just an intellectual understanding, but it's like an emotional connection. Like you feel a connection with the text on a much deeper level. It really becomes something that's very sacred. It becomes something which is part of yourself, part of your own consciousness, part of how the structure of your mind is formed. It's not just a bunch of words sitting on a page that you can agree with or disagree with, but it becomes a part of how your mind works at a very fundamental level. So this is really why I believe that the oral tradition is so important in Buddhism, and why in the Indian spiritual traditions they didn't develop the written word early, and why even when they did develop the written word, it never fully replaced the oral tradition of memorizing texts. And as we know, even today, there are some bhikkhus who have memorized the entire Tripitaka and even the commentaries as well. One of those managed to get in the Guinness Book of World Records. World's best, amazing, most amazing feat of memory, memorizing the whole Tripitaka. And you know, you can see this incredible devotion, incredible feeling of connection with these teachings and these texts, to be able to devote the time and the care to memorizing, to knowing those things really well. And so if we're here as students, as disciples of the Buddha, practitioners who want to follow in the Buddha's path, then we should devote ourselves to that, to try and do it as best we possibly can, to really bring a sense of quality to it, and not just sort of mumble it out vaguely or incoherently, but really try to do it as best we possibly can. And remember that story in the in the Vinaya, in the Khandakas, where Sona, the monk from the distant Avanti country, after he's ordained in the Avanti, tells his preceptor that he wants to go to visit the Buddha, and gets his blessing and travels all the way to Savatthi to see the Buddha. And that night, the Buddha tells Ananda to arrange a place for Sona to stay, young monk to stay in the Buddha's kuti. Imagine that. Imagine if you arrived there at the Buddha, you know, you come all the way from this distant country, you've walked for so long, and you're so full of this devotion and faith for the Buddha, and you get there and the Buddha says, oh fine, you can stay in my kuti. My goodness, what would you feel like? Be so excited, so nervous, what's he going to do? Maybe I'm going to see some really cool psychic powers, you know. So you get there and they sat meditation in the evening together, and then the Buddha said, invited the young monk to recite some Dhamma. And again, imagine how that would feel like, yeah, if you're just a young monastic and the Buddha asks you, please, you know, I'd love to hear you reciting some Dhamma. And you actually have to recite some of the Buddha's suttas to the Buddha himself. I'd be nervous, wouldn't you? I'd be very nervous. And I certainly wouldn't want to make any mistakes. And so Sona recited very beautifully the verses from the Atthakavagga of the Sutta Nipata. And the Buddha praised him for his clarity and the skill with which he recited. So it wouldn't it be nice to think that if we were in a similar situation, which of course in a way we will be, we will be in situations where we are chanting together with the Sangha, joining in the Sangha, and from different traditions, in different ways, in ceremonies, in different countries, and so on. And it'd be nice to think that we can also recite in a way that's beautiful, that's clear, that shows that sense of skill, that shows that sense that we as Buddhist monastics care, we have a faith, we have a commitment to these teachings, and we love to put the time and the energy into learning these things so that we can apply them in our lives really well, and so that we can try to manifest them as best as we possibly can. And so this is, for me, this is something which has always been something that's made me happy. I did put the effort into learning chanting. Actually, what happened was that when I was a novice, I hadn't really learnt any chanting, and I'd been very lazy with it. And then I went on to one house dharma, house chanting with a small group of monks, and I was with three bhikkhus, and I was the novice, and two of the other bhikkhus hadn't actually learnt their chanting properly and were really bad at it, and so it ended up being basically the Ajahn chanting and then the other monks kind of mumbling along beside him, trying to give a little bit of support but not really succeeding in doing any. And so the lay people kind of made some remarks afterwards about how the monks weren't really all that good at chanting that day. I don't know if they felt that the quality of the blessing wasn't going to be so powerful. But anyway, so I apologized to the Ajahn and promised that I would learn the chanting very well, so that didn't happen again. And so that's always born, you know, been something I've been very pleased that I did that. And since then I've, you know, been in many different situations in different countries, reciting, chanting either by myself or with different sangha from different traditions and so on. And it's always been very uplifting and very beautiful to be able to join in and to do the chanting in the different styles and so on that the different traditions are doing. So it's just a few thoughts and reflections on an encouragement on chanting and how to do it and what the meaning of it is. So I offer this for your reflection this evening. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
What about the breathing and chanting?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I find sometimes, you know, halfway through my throat locks up,
uh-huh.
and then I have to stop and wait for it to recover, and then I can go again.
Huh. Yeah. Well, that's not good, is it? That only happens when you're chanting?
Yeah. Usually at about the same time period.
Huh. I'm not quite sure about that. That's quite a. You might want to ask someone who.
Well, I think it's like singing. If you don't breathe, you don't have any. Nothing comes out. So you have to be aware of using your breath, not just holding your breath and just saying the words, but just like falling into your breath with the words, the rhythm of the. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, you have nothing coming out. You have no volume if you don't breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe what's happening is that if you're breathing out too much, not breathing in enough, then after a certain amount of time, your blood oxygen goes down. There's nothing left. But yeah, very much, you know, should try to remember to breathe through the belly and sort of breathe out and breathe sort of deeply. And there are some specific exercises which you can learn to try to free up your voice and so on. And if you listen to yourself chanting, oh, that's something I was going to say as well. But if you listen to yourself chanting, if you just sort of chant something that you know very well, so you don't have to worry about the words, like chant Buddhang Saranam Gacchami or something, and then just as you keep on doing that, then just pay attention to how that's like cycling or moving through your body, and how you're breathing and making sure that you're breathing it, but also to feel the kind of the sound coming up from the belly, and you can feel it coming up through and into the head, and you can actually feel it resonating through the whole body rather than just coming out of the one place in the throat. And you can actually open it up and make it come more out. I mean, my own voice is pretty bad, but I learnt through singing, I learnt a little bit how to do that and how to open it up, so that it kind of got better than it was before anyway. But what I was going to mention earlier was also just something about when we're chanting, the best experience or the best way of doing it is when we know the chant so well and we're really into it, and you can just really, you just get into the zone. So you're just kind of there and it just sort of comes out. And you can almost kind of step back from it a little bit and just sort of watch yourself as you're chanting, and it just sort of allowing that kind of natural flow. And that's really kind of the best way of doing it. And for me, that comes mostly when reciting the Parimokkha, especially if I've had a chance to practice it and prepare it and so on. And then because that, you know, that just really just kind of rolls out. But what usually happens, of course, is that it's rolling out and it's flowing really well. And then that goes for a while, and then you think, oh, this is flowing really well. And then, of course, you stumble over it. So if you know that the chants, you know, that well, really well, so that it just flows effortlessly, then that's terrific. Now, we might know the chants a little bit less well, so that they don't necessarily flow out, and then we have to put a little bit more effort in when we're chanting. So, for example, for myself these days, when we're doing the Karita chants, because we don't do them so often these days, say in Mangala Sutta, then sometimes I mix up the order of the verses. So what I try to do is when I'm reciting one verse, then I remember what's the first word of the next verse. Sometimes you can do that while you're just doing the little refrain at the end, etam mangalam uttamang, and then you prepare in your mind what's the first word of the next verse. Because, of course, what you tend to find when chanting in a group is that most people are usually silent or very quiet on the first syllable of a verse. I don't know if you've observed this phenomenon. And once we get it, then okay, we kind of join back in. So it's really useful. Because just to remember that, you know, you're not always going to be following somebody else who's chanting. You will be leading it yourself sooner or later. So, you know, make sure that you know what is that next line. And you can even think about it beforehand, make sure that you know each one. That's pretty much it, which is one of the reasons that particular style is much better for if it's a decent sized group, then it's fine. But if it's just one or two people, actually can be a bit awkward sometimes. And probably a better way, I mentioned this briefly in the cave the other week, but probably better way is the Sri Lankan style, which where you have an actual full stop at the end of each line. But the trick with the Thai style, to be able to do it, it's a bit like playing a didgeridoo. Mm. You sort of have to keep on going. But the trick to doing it is that you breathe in on the doubled consonants. Yeah. So that gives you a little chance you can breathe in. So without having to mess up the rhythm. Yeah.
So will you be breathing in small gasps throughout every double consonant?
Pretty much, yeah.
Or trying to get one big gasp.
If you can. Let's give some examples. Let's start with the Mangala Sutta. Asevana cha bhavanam panditanam cha sevana puja cha pujaniyanam etam mangalam uttamam. So if I was reciting that, I would probably, again, reading at the end of lines is usually good if you can. Asevana cha bhavanam panditanam cha sevana puja panditanam cha sevana puja cha pujaniyanam etam mangalam uttamam patirupa desa vaso cha pu me cha katapunyata atta samma panidhi cha etam mangalam uttamam. Something like that. It's an artificial chanting style. Like the more, you know, realistically, that each line should correspond to a breath, you know, and that's definitely more of a... Rhythm. That's another good point I was going to mention is that when you're chanting, again, if you can, is to listen to the group chanting rather than just listening to yourself chanting. Yeah? So you want to kind of mainly listen to the leader, because you know, everyone's supposed to follow one way of doing it, but also to listen to what the group as a whole sounds like. Yeah. But could I ask you can you chant for us a couple of verses in the Sri Lankan style so we can listen? A couple of verses from Mangala Sutta or something?
Actually, my chanting is quite international now. Actually, I was very tired by the chanting. And after that, I went to Burma, I chant with Burmese men.
Yeah.
When I went to Sri Lanka, I have a chant with Sri Lankan men.
Yeah.
Now it's mixed up.
Mixed up, yeah.
With regards to, it kind of touches on to what I was saying before. Are you happy with there's one thing I noticed with chanting almost universally, is when people chant, they all breathe at the same time and they all exhale at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they run out of breath at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no continuity. So I try to break that up a bit. So if you've got we'll do a practical demonstration of the Karaniya Metta Sutta.
All right.
Are you happy to lead on the Karaniya? Because the leader will always go first,
right,
and always get run out of breath first.
Karaniya Matta Kusalena Yantam Santam Padam Abhisameja Kakko Ujuja Suvajuja Suvajuja.
And where you're running out of breath at the end of Abhisameja, if I start at Matta Kusalena, I've still got a bit more breath going in my lungs. So you've got the continuity still rolling.
Yeah.
Whereas if everybody starts at Karaniya, so to speak, then they're all round of breath at Abhisamecha, so then there's this big pause before the Sakko Uju can kick in. So if you breathe at a different stage from what everybody else is doing, then there's a continuity of a rolling.
Yeah.
I always want to think of chanting twice as well. To basically cover for the lead chanting, basically the breath. Not stop with them. There is that instant you stop. Basically follow them, like, follow the leader. Don't do that.
Yeah, look, I mean, normally it's done in octaves. That's true. I mean, I try to be consistent, but obviously you can't. You just start at a different pitch. I mean, maybe you need to have a pitchfork or something like that to give a time. But then other people are saying, I know. Yeah, you have to try and struggle. Generally speaking, it's pitched at an octave. Yeah, I mean, if you can't hit the octave, then to hit a fifth is all right.
There's also a tendency from chanting, if somebody starts low, towards the end it always drops. It tends to drop as the chanting's going.
It does tend to drop.
So if you start with Karaniya Matta, after by the end of it, it's like I get what you're saying, because I've heard that thing many times. You know, somebody starts really low at the beginning, and it's just like, this is just going to be suffering at the end.
It was always the struggle, because I used to lead the chanting in Nana chant, and that was always the struggle. Was you had to start by intentionally pitching it a bit high, because by the end it's way too low. And then sometimes, but that's also sometimes to pay attention to. Sometimes if it does drop too much, that I will pitch it up when we start the new chanting. So to be aware of that.
I'm sure you could just see the person who just died, but sometimes the person who died so low, it's difficult for other person. Me, I used to use a very low voice. I used to chant it, I do very low voice. the way you do it is the voice is coming around your mouth or coming around your from the chest. Sometimes we do the voice coming around your belly from the abdomen. So it's difficult for other people to chant. But if we do the voice around the neck, it's later on just a little we find it difficult to chant, but other people come out easier.
Have you heard the Dhammarorans chanting, the one having the say? So the story about it, it's, he was a student of Buddha Gosa in past life.
Yeah.
What do you think about that style of chanting?
It's beautiful.
It's archaic.
Quite likely, yeah. I mean, it doesn't seem to, it's hard to say, but it certainly doesn't seem to be the same as any contemporary Sri Lankan style, as far as I know. Did you hear any chanting like that while you were in Sri Lanka? Anyone that's been in Sri Lanka?
No.
I don't think so. I've never heard anything.
No.
But, certainly that, my understanding is that it would always be chanted with a simple melody that he uses.
Mm.
So it's, similar to what he uses.
I know I've got quite a lot of chanting on the MP3, but I listen to his chanting, so it's change the speed, so it's much deeper. It actually sits down very similar to how I know it.
It's a very distinctive melody. But it's recognisably Sri Lankan's accent in terms of the accents of the Pali and stuff. So it's not connected, but the particular melody and stuff that he uses is I haven't heard from anyone else.
Chanting is not distinct than the Pali chanting. If we want to learn Pali word by word, it's better to learn in the Pali, in the Sri Lankan chanting, not the Pali. Pali is your one to another, and it's difficult to make sense of it. Learning meaning is not distinct.
Yeah.
But for the Sri Lankan, it's hard, it's easier.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not distinct word by word.
I think so, yeah. I think it's simply because the Sinhalese language is still closer to Pali, so it's more natural idiom. It's more natural with Thai pronunciation of Pali. It's quite good, but it's quite artificial. It's not a natural language. That's something I sort of copied after I was in Bodh Gaya with Bhante Nyanananda, Kirit Bhagavad Nyanananda. And so it was kind of similar to the style that he uses in for chanting the Tripitaka chanting. I quite liked it because it's got a little bit of a melody. It actually makes it easier to memorize things if you have a bit of a melody. I mean, that's why it's very hard to remember a poem, but it's very hard to forget a song. Yeah? So it has a little bit of melody, actually makes it a lot easier. And as I said, historically, I'm sure that they would have been recited with a simple melody. Yeah.
Is that what a meter is? I can't understand what a meter is.
No, a meter is the rhythm of it. So meter is the, like in Pali, the meter in Pali is usually defined by both the number of syllables in a line and also the particular arrangement of long and short syllables. So that's what defines a meter. So say in the Mangala Sutra is a typical kind of 8-syllabled meter. Bahu Deva Manu Sacha. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, so that's an 8-syllable meter. So each of the lines has more or less 8 syllables, and in certain positions among those 8 will either be short or long, and in some positions can be either short or long. So the early meters tend to be less strict, whereas the later ones are more strict. So that's why you notice the Metta Sutta has a more consistent rhythm compared to the Mangala and Ratna Suttas, the later metrical style. And
you're not understanding the meter system for chanting?
Probably not really. It's useful if you're studying Pali, but it's more actually just something that you feel intuitively. You feel meter of it. I mean, you're always using meters if in any song or anything like that always has its own particular meter in English, but you don't necessarily know what it is.
You make, and
your
dream
makes
it easier to remember.
Makes it easy to remember, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure when chanting very frequently, it satisfies your emotion as well.
Yeah.
It sustains some kind of trusted emotion.
Yeah.
That's a good chant.
Yeah.
Sanjay, what do you think about learning sutras in English? Because I quite like learning the Pali, but I find it takes me ages to figure out the meaning.
Sure, if you're learning sutras in English is great. Yeah, I mean, I used to do that as well. Before I learned Pali, I used to memorize sutras in English, and memorize the Patimokkha in English before I learned it in Pali. So it's always good. Of course, I never found it's not as good for reciting, but